Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, we have the opportunity to meet another woman whose life has taken a very interesting and often challenging path. Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to welcome to you Kevany Gilmore, who is the founder of Speak Life Consulting Company, which is a training, coaching, and marketing organization designed to help social service agencies addressing the needs of teens transitioning from the foster care system. Kevany Gilmore, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Now, Kevany, you come to your interest and your passion for upgrading, shall we say, the foster care system through your own personal experiences in foster care.
Right.
So I would like to kind of start from the beginning of you, and ask you to tell us where you were born and what you recall of your early days.
Okay, well, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I am, I'm 31 now, but when you say when it all started, I can think about how my mom was a young mom. She was a teen mom. In fact, she told me she prayed for me. And my biological father was extremely physically abusive to her. So there was some drug use and abuse to her prior to me getting to know her. When I say getting to know her, getting old enough to recognize her challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the oldest of five kids. I have one brother. And, you know, my mom was a hustler. And part of that transition into her parenting style. So I can remember her, you know, doing things that she wasn't supposed to do in front of us, like stealing or lying to get certain things that she needed for us. And you know, just real fly lady, wanted to do comedy and outgoing, but also very nurturing to other people. So I saw some good in her, and I also saw some bad. And I don't know, I thinking back to those times, she wanted to really pursue her career in comedy. And I think now that I'm a mom and I can identify with some of those challenges, probably felt slighted with having children so early back to back, and we paid the price for that. So she made us all play crazy for Social Security. That was part of how she got her income. And that just created so many barriers for me when it was time for me to transition into foster care.
Well, so let me ask you this. When you say she made you all play crazy, what do you mean?
Okay. So, like, you know, you would go to the doctor's office and you'd say, well, I'm hearing voices. So naturally, if you're hearing voices, there are some mental health challenges. And I would be admitted into psychiatric wards and have to take the medication and still play the game and simultaneously take medicine that I didn't need. So that was part of her hustle. So all five of us received Social Security. And it was probably cool for her for the income, but when I start to be more assertive about the things that I was seeing going on at home, because they did use drugs, and there was a lot of physical abuse from my stepfather. I mean, he would lock me in a room from the outside, and you have to knock on the door, knock on your own door to use the bathroom and get food. So I got like tired of that, and I became a runaway. So when I say that, it creates barriers. Because by the time I got into foster care, I'm black, I'm a teenager, and I have mental health issues.
Right.
On paper.
And severe mental health issues if you're hearing voices.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Which created barriers for placements when it was time to go into care, because they have to say all those things. Like, you know, 13, black, yeah, there's mental health challenges. And, of course, a foster parent, if they have children or in general, will inquire, well, what are they? Well, she hears voices. So definitely created barriers. And I didn't understand at that time that until I got into foster care and a little bit older that we were poor, even though she was doing what she thought was necessary to generate money, you know, getting WIC and getting food stamps and how we lived, I didn't realize that I was poor. So
it's interesting as you describe the really challenging world into which you were born. You're the oldest of five, so you had four siblings, and so it sounds like the house was kind of crowded.
Well, interesting enough, everyone had their own room the second time that we moved, so it wasn't crowded in that realm. But just looking at the poverty mindset of my mom, and understanding now as a parent and as an adult and what it takes to live a day-to-day life and, you know, put gas in the car and eat. We were poor, but we shouldn't have been, because if all five of us, for when we think about salary-wise, all five of us was receiving income. So she had to at least be getting at least at bare minimum $3,000 or $3,500. And some people can live off that and live off of it comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
But the poverty mindset of having to use your children, right, is like cash cows, for lack of better words, to even go through all of that to attract money opposed to working and getting an education and all of those things. And I don't say those things to downplay my mom, because I think she did what she thought was necessary at that time. But now that I'm older and I've had an opportunity to get college educated, I see that, you know, that's not the right way to go in terms of how we attract benefits and even using the government in that realm.
And of course, by creating conditions under which each of her children could be diagnosed with a severe psychiatric illness, then the Social Security payments were higher.
Exactly.
So in the scheme of things, when you say she was getting about $3,500, was that a month?
Right.
Okay. So in the scheme of things, I mean, there are lots of people even today who could certainly live off $3,500 a month and wish they had $3,500 a month. So on the one hand, you're right. I mean, creating conditions where she had and certainly at that point, $3,500 a month went a lot further than it would go today. As you were living at home with your mom, in and out of hospitals, being exposed to taking pretty significant psychotropic drugs, how did you manage in school with friends? What was that like for you?
Well, you know, I loved school because school was like an outlet for me. It was like a club, right? You get a chance to socialize with people, and I wasn't able to have company and talk on the, you know, phone. So I loved school in that realm. But there was times, depending upon the medicine that I took, and I've taken several, so Wellbutrin, Prozac, Zoloft, where I felt like zombie-like, really drained, very tired. By the time school would start, or by the time that I would get home, and that I don't think that I'm totally against medicine, probably because of how it was done to me, and having the opportunity to substitute teach in the district for about 6 years, and watching how many African American boys were diagnosed. I always think about my own, you know, trauma with, are their diagnoses even real, or is this part of their mom's hustle?
Yeah.
So, yeah, school was, I definitely liked school, but yes, there was those challenges with feeling like drained, zombie-like, very tired.
Well, and from what you describe, you were taking antidepressants, anti-anxieties, and probably, I would think you would have to have been given some anti-psychotic medication, given the diagnosis that you were being given along the way. So even as
right,
you were in school, your school performance was not a true reflection of you as the individual. It was so much impacted upon by the medication you were taking.
Right.
At what point did you think about relationships with boys or with girls? Did you date while before going into foster care? Was any of that a part of your life?
I'm thinking. So my mother, her personality type is very like raw and uncut in terms of how she would tell me what a man was. So if I could be frank, she would say, like, if a man gets on top of you and he's just pumping you, he's not making love to you, he's, am I allowed to curse? No, you can't. He would be you know what in you. So yeah. There was that. And then my stepfather would say, if you give a man, you know, that, then that's all you have. There's nothing left. So those things were pretty much embedded before I left, because I went into foster care at 13.
Okay.
And even with those things being embedded, I lost my virginity at 13, because the person that I gave it to posed as a friend to me.
Sure.
And with all the challenges that I was having with the physical abuse and the mental abuse, and like that person at that time to me feeling like they were there, I felt like that was like a gift that I was giving away, but not really understanding at that time what sex really was. I remember having it and coming home and trying to watch Teen Summit, because I didn't have that relationship with my mom to say to her, like, this happened, I wasn't happy because of the ramifications that would happen. I probably would have got beat up half to death. Who knows? So part, you know, and they always say, like, your first relationship is like with your dad, and, you know, that's how you attract a certain man that you like. So going into foster care and being in, I was in a total of 13 placements. So they were ranging from psychiatric wards, shelter care facilities, detention centers, and foster homes. So one portion of my life was just seeing girls. That was never like my thing. I kind of thought that even with all the physical abuse that they did to me and my siblings, they still sent us to church. So I was just like, I just thought that was unclean. And that experience being in all the detention centers and seeing girls doing things like that, and just not feeling comfortable with that. But by the time I was able to get into high school, I went to 5 different high schools. I didn't even really know how to build rapport or relationships with men, because I was so used to moving and so used to, like, you know, not being able or having this fear, like, oh, you know, I might get kicked out of this foster home. So it's no use to me getting to know you all like that. And that really did carry on into my adult life, where I had, I guess as most women would say, like, staying power. I didn't have a lot. I still don't have, like, a lot of staying power. I see something that I don't like, and it's just like, uh-oh, you know, where communication would be important to other women mm-hmm. in relationships. It's always created barriers for how I grew up for me in terms of dating.
Between the 13 placements and the 5 different high schools and all of the chaos that's going on at home, it's no wonder that you didn't have exposure to healthy, supportive relationships.
No, I didn't.
What happened that brought you to the attention of the foster care system? You said you went in at the age of 13.
Right. I was a runaway, so okay. I constantly ran away. In fact, my ninth grade year, I was at John Hay High School, and I started to, like, load my locker. So, like, maybe every other day I was taking, like, an outfit. And that particular summer, if that happened for me, that I ran away, I was in summer school. Like I said, I always liked school, and I took all my things and was running away, but I was still attending school, summer school. And my mom, like, had me arrested from school. She, like, knew where to find me. So that led me into going to the detention center. I have to back up. At 12, I, like, tried to commit suicide. I got to back up. So what it did was make it look like my profile was correct. Like, wow, now she's even suicidal, right? So I'm hearing voices and I'm suicidal. And when I, like, woke up from trying to commit suicide, at 12, I was thinking, like, okay, well, maybe God just really wanted me here. And I took all my allergy medication. And because I didn't die, I started to be a runaway. So that was, like, carrying on into me being 13. And so my mom would go and file unruly charges. And at some point, they kept me. So I was at the detention center for about 90 days, and my mom would refuse to take me home during those hearings. And so I went from the detention center being there, being down with that like 90-day time, and then going to a shelter care facility in Youngstown, Ohio, because my mom was refusing to take me home. And this became like a pattern of them like not really knowing where to send me. And at the time, me being fearful to talk about why I was running away, because I was always afraid that they would send me back home and I would get, you know, beat up for telling what
the
was
truth.
Happening
yeah.
in the house.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. When you were 12 years old, did anybody really, and tried to commit suicide, did anybody really try to understand what prompted that behavior, or did they merely chalk it up to this is part of the diagnosis that she has?
Oh no, nobody tried to understand that. And you got and keep in mind too, I'm in character to some degree. So when I go into the hospital, I start to like going to the psychiatric ward because it was like a vacation. I knew when I was in there, I wasn't going to get beat up for something petty. Because if you ate out of the refrigerator in my house without asking, I was stealing. Mm-hmm. My stepfather would make me wake up at like 4 a.m. and do push-ups, sit-ups, knee bends, because he did have a military background. And I was the oldest of five, so I was watching kids a lot, like a surrogate mom. So I started to appreciate going to this place and enjoying art therapy and observing the behaviors of the other kids and knowing like, okay, well, I'm not going to like spaz out in here because they're not going to inject me with medication.
Okay.
And I got to a point where I just started like playing like I was taking, you know, the pill, even though they make you do the flick your tongue up thing. And I was still fearful in that realm where I'm not going to say, well, hey, I really don't hear voices, because then they would tell my mom and I would have to go back home and I would get in trouble because this was
right.
her hustle.
Right.
And she had even said at one point, like, well, you have to take the medication because if they blood test you, it has to be in there. You're not going to, you know, F up my money. So
okay.
I'm like, oh, okay.
Okay, so you learned clearly too much the wrong way, way too soon,
mm-hmm.
many, many, too many responsibilities, and a great deal of depression, which is completely understandable.
Right.
So at 13, you went into foster care. Do you remember the first foster care environment you were in?
I remember that like it was yesterday. I can remember the smells and everything like it was yesterday. Part of what happened is that after, you know, going to those different the detention center, the shelter care facility, and then they sent me back to the detention center because you have this 90-day window. And I had good behavior in both of those places. So when they sent me back, there was a social worker who was just like, Kevin, we don't understand. Your behavior isn't a challenge here. Tell me what is going on. And I told her what the challenges were, and what she did was she called my grandmother. And at the time, my grandmother was living in East Cleveland in a senior citizen apartment that went by her income, and was suffering from breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And she still took me in, and she pretty much snuck me in, because you know when you get that type in that you're in that type of housing, you're
right.
not allowed to have a visitor. So I was grateful for that, and I've always, like, been her favorite. I know this was someone who genuinely loved me. The challenge with living with her, though, is that she had a boyfriend who was younger who would say sexually inappropriate things, and he smoked crack. So I was afraid, even living in her place. Like, I was grateful to be there, but I was thinking, like, you know, someone would knock on the door that he owed money to for drugs. I would, like, visualize stuff like this. Or, you know, I would be scared thinking that at some point that he would physically touch me. So my grandmother had her breast removed on the same day that I had a hearing, and the county took emergency custody. They put me on probation when they sent me to my grandmother. So my probation officer took me to Children and Family Services. And I remember the sun being up. By the time I found a placement, the sun being down. And I watched them call people and say African American, 13 years old. Yes, there's some mental, you know, like try to turn their faces like, yeah, right. You know, there's some mental health challenges. I remember what the lady's car was. It was a blue Escort that said taken to. I remember it so much so that I saw her like 10 years later and she still smelt the same.
Oh my.
So they put me in a, yeah, it was, it's right. I can identify her from anywhere. In court, of course, she didn't remember me, but that smell was still the same for her. They put me at home in Shaker Heights, and I remember driving, you know, with the social worker and looking like, ooh, I wonder if it's this house, I wonder if it's this that house, and thinking like, oh, I hope it's these rich white people that like treat me like the best kid ever. And it wasn't. It was an African American woman who worked from home and who had a son and had another young girl who's a foster kid. And I remember us having to sleep in a bunk bed. So I was pretty upset by that because I was like, whoa, sure. Wait a
not,
minute.
Not what you wanted, right? Kevin,
yeah,
we're going to take
a
break.
I had a canopy bed.
So a bunk bed was a real come down from that. Kevin,
we're in Shaker Heights. I'm thinking I was going, whoa, you know, have, you know, my own nice room, you know.
Not
so that
so
was
much.
A challenge for me.
And absolutely.
The girl was about 5 years old, so you can just imagine what that's like trying to go to bed and her moving and her wanting to talk.
Right.
So I remember feeling slighted in that moment that, you know, that I was even sharing a room because I hadn't even shared a room with my sisters when I left. So
gotcha. Kevin, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to pick up right here and continue hearing about that first foster care experience. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Kevin E. Gilmore, who is an advocate for the needs of children who are in the foster care system transitioning out. We'll be right back. Kevin, how long were you in that first foster care home?
That home setting was very short-lived, and it goes back to everything I said before because of why I came in and how I came in. If I can remember it clearly, maybe at the most about 90 days. Okay. I might even give it 4 months to be safe. Because I came to the Shaker Heights home on probation, and I came with all those mental health assumptions, and that was all written up in my report. And I remember part of the challenge in that home was that I did not know how to be a kid, and that was a problem for her. And when I say that, like at home, I could wash the clothes, I could sort them, I was cooking for my siblings, I was washing their hair, I was doing their hair. So for someone to like make me lunch and have me dropped off at their grandmother's house, you know, while their son was getting a chance to explore and engage in a child appropriate activities, that was a problem for me. And I think that, and I was older than her son, so when I got there, I was in the 10th grade by then.
Okay.
She didn't like that, you know, that I was already pretty much, not necessarily assertive, but independent, I think, from what I could remember. And I also remember, like I said, feeling slighted, not being able to go to some of the same activities. And at that time, in her defense, there were barriers put in place about when and where a kid could go in terms of spending the night and things like that.
Okay.
One of the things I did appreciate is that she made sure, you know, that my hair was done. So I did go to, like, her hairstylist. But I don't think that she was ready to deal with, like, a teen girl. And ironic enough, and I've lost things, I've been addicted, I've had things tore up, stolen from me, I still have the robe that she made me wear around the house. So in my mind at that time, I was thinking, she had brought a little anxiety thinking, are you making me wear the robe because of size, because of your significant other, or is that just the way that a woman should walk around the house? So I looked at that in two ways.
Interesting.
So from that home, though, I had to go to another facility. I was actually arrested from Shaker Heights High School in the 10th grade. How embarrassing, right? 10th grade, arrested from my probation officer. And there was no room in the detention center. So they put me in, like, this shelter care place on the west side of Cleveland. It was called Safe Haven. And they put me there. So as I was waiting there, I was waiting to be placed somewhere else because she didn't want me there. Okay, so I think
Why were you arrested?
Because I violated probation. So okay. What happened is when there were challenges where her and I could have talked and build a rapport, and I can't even remember how simple the challenges were. I mean, they were minor things from what I remember. Maybe I came home a little late or something like that, and Shaker was new to me. So at home, I lived on 100 in Cedar, and anyone from Cleveland who's listening knows where that area is. It's where it's been totally redeveloped by Cleveland Clinic. And going to John Hay, there was not a lot of diversity at all.
I
don't even remember anyone Caucasian that went to the school. So going to Shaker was a culture shock for me. You had everybody in there. So I wanted to do things that, you know, the girls was doing, and not necessarily the fast things that they were doing, but there were sports and there was all type of after school activities that I didn't have a opportunity to participate in. And then looking at how they dressed, what they drove, how their parents dropped them off. I felt slighted going there, but also I appreciated my surroundings. So she didn't really nurture me. So every time there was a challenge, she would call the probation officer. So the probation officer would talk to me like, well, hey, Kevin, you know. And it would be normal teen girl challenges.
Gotcha.
I'm not stealing things, you know, not letting sneaking boys in her house. In fact, I never stayed at her house by myself. She would literally take me to her grandmother's house. Now, if she's older than me, then, you know, granny is older than her. So I'm sitting
right
at her grandmother's house, like, watching TV, like old TV, too. And it's, like, hot. No offense, because, you know, most older women keep the heat up. She would call him. So I was arrested in school for violating probation. I don't even honestly at this point remember exactly what I did.
Okay.
It was just that people remember that to this day, that I was arrested at school. So they put me so look at all these places. On Shaker Heights to the west side of Cleveland. From the west side of Cleveland, because there was no detention centers, all the way in Delaware, Ohio, in a group home. From Delaware, Ohio, in a group home and waiting for a court hearing for violating probation, which I should have never been on in the first place because I was running away from mental and physical abuse. They put me in Hudson for 15 months. Hudson, Ohio, in a facility that was supposed to house kids who had challenges.
Okay.
So I'm losing out on all my
everything, yeah.
Yeah, interpersonal skills, you know, getting a chance to be a teenager, schooling, because you know for a fact they're not giving me the same education that I just got in Shaker Heights, and that's supposed to be creme de la creme here in Cleveland to some degree for education, all because of a personality conflict with a foster parent.
Wow. You went through so many different homes and placements and people. At what point were you in the system and feeling helped by being in the foster care system? Ever?
No. No. I didn't feel helped until I was 18 and I met Sanine Cook. Now, Sanine Cook was not my worker. She's a social worker for the Department of Children and Family Services here in Cleveland. But she was picking up the slack of someone else who wasn't doing their job. So when you go to college, and I only went to college for a place to stay. That's how it was presented to me. I didn't have anywhere to live when I turned 18. I was told that if I didn't have $250 for rent, that I had to leave. And so the social worker that I had at the time was like, well, Kevinie, you don't have any money. You might as well go to college. And I told her, you have to be smart to go to college. I'm not smart enough to go to college. I've been to 5 different high schools, and it took me to the 12th grade to pass the 8th grade math proficiency test. I can't go there. I was afraid to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go to college, and here in Cuyahoga County, you are given a college bound check. What that is $20 a day per diem that you're in college or job training program. And I hadn't known that I was supposed to get that. So months had went by and I hadn't got that. So I went to school in the summertime and I met Sanine Cook. And when I met her, she was the first person who allowed me to be Kevinie. And at that time, Kevinie was off the hook. I was angry. I was hurt.
Of course.
I was frustrated. I was miserable. I was scared. I was all of those things. And I was confused about the why. And I also had this sense of entitlement too, like, well, you guys took me, so you guys need to figure out what I'm supposed to do.
Gotcha.
So I was a gum popping, scarf wearing, I don't mind cussing you out in a second, because so many people have hurt me and I've been so quiet for so long that I'm going to say how I feel. And she just listened. I mean, I was going off. She just sat there. She didn't interject, like, don't use that word. She just listened.
She just let you be you. She let you be you.
She let me be me. She did. And that relationship has carried on from 18 into 31. Had it not been for her, I would not have graduated from college. She has been to me like a mom subconsciously. That's where I've placed her. And I can't get all emotional when I talk about her because I feel like I'm choking up. But she just cared. And she didn't just care about Kevinie. It's so many other kids that she cared about and that she really took the time to nurture. So I didn't get the attention and nurturing and love and affection, or even that, wow, Kevinie, you got an A on that paper. Let me help you with that paper. You could have said that better, until after I got out of care from Sanine Cook.
Let me ask you this. We hear about kids transitioning, aging out of the foster care system. What does that mean, aging out of the foster care system?
It means that you turned 18 without being adopted. So aging out is the term that they use in that realm. So like me, I went to court on my 18th birthday. So June 21st, they were just like, you know, you're emancipated. And I remember saying to myself, emancipated? That's what they did to the slaves, Emancipation Proclamation. I didn't even understand really what was going on aside from that I was free from the foster care system. And then it didn't get real until I got back to that home. She's like, well, I'm not going to get any more money from you, because not only are you 18 now, you graduated from high school. So aging out is going through the system to your 18th birthday without being adopted.
And how do they prepare you for being suddenly quote-unquote free?
You know, And that is, that's what wakes me up every day to be able to talk about foster care. I don't think they do a good job at that. So I aged out in 2002, and it's 2015 now. I don't have to be, you and I are doing an interview for millions of people to hear and get inspired. We don't have to even see each other. So technology has improved tremendously, but this system has not. So part of what they have kids do is these independent living classes that's supposed to set you up for the real world. And it varies from city to city, county to county in terms of how they do it. So from what I've observed, you take this like test. It asks you questions that really don't challenge your mind. You're not really getting real life experiences of like sitting in eviction court, right? Because that's what's going to happen because you don't have independent living skills, or going to physically go to an apartment and see what that process looks like. Not to buy this car that has 100,000 something miles on it, or even what your credit is, or if a family member has credit in your name, how to have protected sex. Because statistically, they're saying that girls will be moms, 71% of girls will be moms by their 21st birthday. And then for our young men, I feel so bad the system is sexist, because if they have a baby, the baby doesn't follow them, right? So they're not even getting a chance to nurture their children or even understand or get parenting classes that they need, because the babies don't follow. But there's a lot of boys who get, you know, girls pregnant while they're in foster care. So the system is doing a horrible job at preparing kids to be adults. So here are the harsh facts. 36% of kids who age out of foster care are going to prison. Between 2-4% will graduate from college. 54% do not graduate with a high school diploma. And I already mentioned the 71% who will be moms before they're 21. Now, I could be wrong, and I usually am, so I might get these statistics a little messed up. But in 2013, there was an FBI sting on human trafficking all over. And close to 61% of those cases were aged out foster youth.
Yeah, that's so easy to believe.
It's sad.
It is.
And what hurts is that it's predominantly African-American kids that are in the system. So we are definitely selling them from a system perspective. And so this is a $9 billion industry. It creates money. Everybody gets paid when a foster kid goes into care. The social worker, the foster parent, the psychiatrist, the drug administration, everybody gets a piece of the pie. Meanwhile, when the kid ages out in Cleveland, they're told to apply for welfare and to apply for CMHA housing, low-income housing, if they have priority. Everybody shouldn't make money and then I live a lifetime of poverty after I've aged out of the system. Because when I was a network marketer, we said that the system was supposed to save you time, energy, and money. And it doesn't, because these kids age out. They're early moms, early dads. They live in low-income housing. Education is extremely low. And we failed them because no one has gotten them to their next economic level. And I got to be honest and say that I've even had challenges throughout my life where I thought it was okay to just go apply for welfare. Or, you know, where's my SSI check? I could go back, you know, to something like that. How did she do that? How did she get that hooked up? I can't make over this amount because I'll lose money in this. Uh-huh. It wasn't until I got into network marketing that my paradigm shifted in terms of how I look at wealth and what wealth is and going after your real goals and dreams.
The numbers that you quote are pretty astounding. And even if they're slightly skew, the bottom line, as you've said, is that most of the children in foster care wind up leaving with a child. That's what most of them do, and most
right.
and the smallest, the tiniest portion actually get to college. So it's interesting to think about how profoundly the children in the system have been failed, and yet how much money is made within that system. I mean, it's almost like the prison system, you know, where everybody makes money except for the people who are supposed to be helped. Kevany, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
All right.
Kevany, as I think about all the things that we've talked about today that you've gone through, it would have been so easy for you to sort of fall completely off the grid into oblivion. And yet you have done something entirely different with your life. What was the impetus? What was the energy behind your energy?
It was definitely, I credit a lot of my success to Sydney Kirk, because she had two of her own children, and even though this was a job, she really took the time to like nurture this whole person. And I found myself simultaneously with getting the nurturing that I need, but also becoming more of a lady. Right, and being quiet. And she was even skilled at allowing me to use that voice in a panel setting. So now I'm empowering other foster parents to take teenagers when we think foster care. Just being close to her and getting the nurturing that I needed, she would tell me about other opportunities that led me to Capitol Hill. I've worked in John Kerry's office. I introduced Hillary Clinton to Case Western Reserve when she came to Cleveland. And that all goes back to that one person who took the time. The other thing that happened for me, like I said, was network marketing. At the time, I was doing Tahitian Noni International, and it wasn't about the money or building the teams or the whole pyramid thing that people think, all that stuff. That's not what did it for me. It was this feeling, this family feeling, this team building feeling, this reading these books, Zig Ziglar and Jim Rohn, and working on personal development. And what put the icing on the cake to all of this was that I watched The Secret. And I watched that about 10 years ago at a time where I wanted to be positive and I wanted to be happy, but I just felt slighted. And I remember Jack Canfield coming on saying how his father was abusive, and I think he said something about him like drinking alcohol or something like that, and that about 89% of families are dysfunctional. They had these series of people who were telling their story. I was homeless in Dallas, and I was like, oh, wait a minute, I was homeless too, trying to go to college during my breaks, holiday breaks. And another person got on like, well, I had learning disabilities. And I was just like, wow, I felt that I wasn't even intelligent enough to go to college. And it was in that moment Jack Canfield said, well, so what? And I'm like, well, yeah, so what, right? So it was like an epiphany that everybody is going through something, and that everybody was raised in something. So what are you going to do next? And I started making dream boards, and I started writing my goals down in present tense, and I tried to read a book a month. And I went to events that had people that were doing better than me, and I would ask them questions. Well, like, how did you get here? What did you do? What do I need to do? So it was this hunger to be better and to have better, and not necessarily financially, because I've had some ups and downs with that, but this feeling within that if things are bad today, it's gonna get so much better tomorrow or next week. So I started looking. It was crazy. Bad things would happen, and then the next good thing that would happen would be so mind-boggling. I started waiting for the bad thing because I wanted to get to the next level, whatever good I had coming. So it was that. And then more recently, I have a son, Caden. He'll be 4 March 3rd. There was these fears, though, that I had underlying home ownership and staying in one place. Because that followed me, that moving from place to place followed me even in my adult life with living in places. I had to leave in a year. I don't know what's going to happen. But he brought this balance to my life where I want to pay things off or pay it up in cash and not be so frugal with my money. I mean, be frugal with my money and be fixated at being even better because I can't see him see me down. So I, you know, in the midst of all of this, there is still this appreciation for my mother because she does suffer from mental health problems. And before meeting me or having me, there were challenges with her family. So I can look at her and be grateful, like, wow, you went through this and you went through that. And you did this to me. You did that. And all that has me here in this good place where I want to help other people. So all my negatives worked, all my positives worked, and it all worked, for lack of better words.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because it sounds like you had, you know, powerful influences on both ends of the spectrum. I mean, certainly without your mom, you wouldn't be here, period. But right. Sunin sounds like she gave you the awareness that you mattered. And perhaps for the first time in a lifetime where you didn't really feel like you did. And now your son, on the other side of that, you want to make sure that he knows that he matters and that he's safe and that he's secure.
Yeah, and I want other foster kids to know that they matter. There's nothing worse than like a grown foster kid, right? They've had all these challenges, all these abandonment issues and this feeling of like not belonging. I have to be honest and say that even with my son, that when the holidays come, I get into this ruckus. I don't want to say depression, but this feeling of wanting the holidays to be over because so many of them have been taken from me. And even though he's excited about the holidays, it's Christmas. I'm like, ooh, let's hurry up and get back to work. There's something about those holidays that I'm fixated on not being able to enjoy them fully. So even in loving him and wanting him to have the best, I want other people who went through this system to use their stories and their challenges as tools. And that was part of like what I did was doing this whole hashtag foster care thing with having people hold the sign and having celebrities hold it and having aged out foster youth and people who were not even in foster care because there's this shame with being in care because you have to tell the story, right? You got to tell the how. So most people think, oh, your mom was on crack. Do you know your parents? There's all these misconceptions.
Exactly.
And people, yeah, they're shameful. So I want them to feel good, too, about it. Like, look at how you came out of it. Everybody doesn't live, you know, this poverty lifestyle. And even if you do, you can still get out of it. You know, you don't have to stay. You can set some goals, set some limits, create some boundaries, and move forward from this system. So,
Kevany, for those listening now who might be contemplating becoming a foster care parent or have foster children now, what are some things that you really want them to think about?
If you want to be a foster parent, like, right, if you're thinking about doing it, don't think about it. Our feelings don't come from nowhere. I believe that when we get thoughts of inspiration, that we're supposed to act on them immediately. That they're not just coming, you know what I mean? Like, out of the sky. They're coming for a reason.
Okay.
And I would say that no going in that you have to be in for the long haul because some of these behaviors, some of these outbursts, and some of the challenges that happen with kids that are in care, don't take them personal. They have nothing to do with you. And oftentimes, kids will create all this turmoil just to see if you'll keep them because we're so used to being kicked out. So I would say have patience. be constantly in prayer and don't take anything personal that's coming from these kids. For the people who are already foster parents now, I would say that you have to be so gentle with people, because one, I do believe that karma is totally real, and two, you're impacting them for the rest of their lives. The things that you say, the foods that you cook, the events that you take them to, I would say treat them how you want to be treated, or how you treat the people that you birth. And if none of those are good, then I would say that you should stop doing foster care and probably focus on yourself, because the ramifications of aging out of care without being nurtured are all those statistics that I mentioned early on. And if you know that you've taken part in those things, then I think that those things internally will affect you health-wise, you know, your income, because we have to pay for the things that we do to people, and we're all here to help each other get to our next level. And we should be doing that in a way that promotes someone's life and well-being for the good.
Do you think that foster care parents get the kind of background checks that are useful, or get the kind of support they need to provide the environment that you describe?
I think one of the things that any person that wants to come into this system needs to be clear about is their why. Like, why are you doing it? Are you doing it because you need to offset, you know, income? Are you doing it because you really want to nurture someone? You want to be part of the change? Like, the why is so important, because no, I don't think that the system prepares them for some of the challenges that the foster kids have. But also, I don't think that they prepare themselves. They're not reading. They're not volunteering in child welfare agencies or nonprofits that have this particular population before they're getting into it. And sadly, when we look at that, it's predominantly African-American kids that are in it, it's predominantly African-American people who are doing foster care. So why are we saying goodbye to our own at 18? So their why has to be something that they're honest with themselves about. Because so many kids get hurt in the system, not just the mental, sexual things happen. You know, I hear so many stories that make me look at my own situation like I was lucky.
Interesting.
So, yeah, they need to be conscious of their why, and they need to explore different agencies, just how you explore what car you want, the mileage that you'll get, you know. And then the other thing is you have to be fixated at staying in for the long haul. So we all had a guy that we liked, or a woman, you know, who's ever listening, that they liked, and it wasn't working. It was not working. You tried everything. You tried different sexual things. You tried to cook. You wore your hair a different way. You colored it. You did all this stuff. You lost weight because you wanted that relationship to work. That is the same way that people have to be about getting kids in their home, because it can work if someone's fixated at making it work like you want it to work for your relationships. I wasn't always good with, you know, I didn't always do things that Ms. Cook liked, and I didn't always say things that she liked, and I had several outbursts, and I've done crazy things, and but she didn't, you know, if she left, she came back, because we're all entitled to our feelings. So people have to know going in that you have to be in for the long haul, and you got to do your own research and read your own books and go to your own training and get the services that you need for yourself too while you're in it. Be good to yourself while you're in it.
Is there any way to combat the experiences that you had where you were so early on diagnosed with having a psychiatric illness that you just didn't have? Is there any way to combat that as you move into the system? Do they just accept whatever the paperwork is that follows a child? Do they do their own evaluations? Could that be going on today?
I think that's something that's definitely that needs to be done. When I think about my brother, so I'm Kevin, he's Kevin, right? We're like little twins. My brother went into care, and I told you, I feel like this system is sexist. He went into care, and he was trying to explain, well, wait a minute, I really don't have a mental health problem, and please don't put me in these smaller classrooms. I'm going to Kennedy High School. I'm a handsome guy. This is a popular, you know, I want to be popular. They're laughing at me in these classes. These, you know, these things that you have on paper aren't correct. Nobody listened to him. Mm-hmm. So in turn, he stopped going to school. And prior to coming into care, he was an honor roll student. And he's serving a 9-year jail sentence now.
Oh,
so
no.
Certainly his behaviors got him where he was at. But what would have made all the difference is if someone would have listened, because he would have been a high school graduate. And he did have a goal to go to Ohio State. That could have manifested, right? Someone just took the time to say, okay, well, prove to us for a month that this isn't real or something like that. Those things stick and they follow you to each home. And then because you already have this preconceived notion when you come to the door, you're not able to create an authentic rapport. See, in my file, like I said, I had mental health challenges. I heard voices. I'm suicidal. I've been to the detention center. I've been to psychiatric wards. They had to put me in Delaware because I'm also a runaway. And then on top of all of that, I still, right? So because in my house, if you took things out the refrigerator, that's stealing. So my mother still had some type of influence on my file, even though she wasn't financially taking care of me anymore.
Interesting.
Like she had no, you know, bearing on me anymore for that matter, because she didn't work a case plan. So yes, I think they should definitely do what is necessary to make sure the things in the file are true. And sometimes it's just simply a personality conflict. I might have a challenge with you today and go to another foster home and I'm great.
So don't assume that everything you see on paper is exactly the truth.
Right. Because
ask questions.
If you want a good resume,
yeah.
We know
yeah.
We can copy and paste if we want a good resume.
This is true. Kevany, I have to thank you so much for spending time with us today. Is there a website or an email address or anything where people could be in touch if they wanted to help you with your work?
Yes, there is a website, but that is under construction. I don't even want to have people go there. And yeah, so, but my email address is KEVINEE. So Kevany. So Kevin with two E's at the end, knows with a K, KNOWS @gmail.com. And my Instagram is Kevy Knows 2, the number 2, so KEVIKNOWS2. And Facebook is just Kevany Gilmore, so KEVINEE Gilmore on Facebook.
And when you get that website up and running, just let me know and I'll make sure to let everybody else know.
Oh, thank you.
Kevany, I thank you so much. You have been through so much, and still you fight, and still you are a role model and a goal model for so many people. Thank you very much for what you do.
And thank you, because you give an opportunity and a platform to, you know, empower people, but also enlighten them for the challenges that are happening out here and how they can create an impact, to be an impact. So I appreciate you as well.
Absolutely.
For the opportunity. Thank you so much.
That's what Mind Talk is all about. All right, Kevany, we will be in touch. And folks, thank you so much for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications and is provided daily as an educational public service. Mind Talk is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And folks, you remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's just plain old unacceptable. You take care.